From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Lawmakers in Washington are playing a game of chicken over a government shutdown. What are the stakes in the fight, and what does it mean for participants in the Children's Health Insurance Program and DACA, two programs that hang in the balance of what is supposed to be a fight over the budget? Steve Bannon testified before the House Intelligence Committee, but he wasn't very forthcoming. Betsy Woodruff of the Daily Beast will tell us why and what he might tell Bob Mueller. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Tom Nichols of the Naval War College will join us to discuss nuclear weapons. A new Pentagon policy might allow for a nuclear response to major cyber attacks. Does that make any sense? And what's our nuclear plan for North Korea? Plus, Neil Ferguson joins us to discuss his new book, The Square and the Tower. The book is about networks versus hierarchies. Neil says the networks are winning, and that should concern you. All that, plus the president and the porn star, is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. As we tape on Friday afternoon, Congress is still trying to find an agreement to keep the government open past the midnight shutdown deadline. A bill to fund the government for a month and also to extend the Children's Health Insurance Program for 6 years passed the House of Representatives Thursday night on a near party line vote. But negotiations are not looking great in the Senate, with the White House having refused a bipartisan proposal on immigration fixes and many Democratic senators saying they won't vote to keep the government open without those fixes. It's not even clear there are 50 Republican votes in the Senate for the House bill. A few Republican holdouts have concerns over immigration, defense spending, and other matters. So some senators in both parties have floated the idea of a bill to keep the government open for just a few days, adding a little time for negotiation over immigration and other matters. So this is a good day for us to be joined by Shia Kabas, who is the director of economic policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a centrist think tank in Washington, D.C. Shia, can you start us with a refresher? What actually happens if the government shuts down?
Sure, Josh. If the government shuts down, we've been there before. It happened in the 1990s. It happened in 2013. There are significant impacts. It's not catastrophic as something like the debt limit could be. But when the government shuts down, non-essential government operations stop. And that includes many, many different functions, but some of the major impacts that are noticed are things like national parks closing across the country, federal employees, many of them not reporting to work because there's not funding to support them. Now, essential employees do still report to work, so people who are, for example, responsible for the actual national security of the country or who are there to run programs that on a day-to-day basis, like the TSA, they don't shut down all air traffic control. But it does have significant impacts for many, many people, both within the federal government, because there are about 800,000, 850,000 employees who got sent home last time, and also people who interact with government services.
So why are we potentially reaching this shutdown, and whose fault is it, essentially, if we end up having one? Rich, Katrina?
This is going to be fought out in the court of public opinion, a lot of messaging, but the Republicans literally control all of Washington. How can the shutdown not be their fault? They could have dealt with this months ago. They just keep on kicking the can down the road. A poll released last Thursday found Americans split the blame between both parties in Congress and Trump. But when you lump Trump in with Republicans in Congress, a majority, 53% blame members of the Republican Party, this was done with zero negotiations with the Democrats. This Republican Party acts as if there's no Democratic Party. And Trump, and Rich could speak more to this, doesn't seem to know what he wants. He contradicts his party's leaders. He did the other day on chip funding. And he certainly threw a wrench into what could have been a bipartisan deal last week with his expletives, his demeaning of thousands of people. So I think the Republicans are to blame, but I think the battle will wage as to who's at fault here. The real problem in one way is that government takes a hit. And I think if you believe that government has a real role for the common good, that's not healthy.
We'll have a blame game, and maybe they'll be able to make anything stick against Donald Trump because he's in such debilitated political state, plus his message discipline, the level of his message discipline is not high, which was a big risk in a showdown like this.
He said in the spring that Washington needed a good shutdown.
Yeah, exactly. So, but Republicans, they have all three elected branches of government. They don't have 60 votes in the Senate, so they were never going to be able to get the spending bill through the Senate without at least 10 Democratic votes, given they have 51 votes and John McCain is ill. Even if they're holding all their own members, they're not, which is going to be an optical problem. But at the end of the day, it is Democrats forcing the shutdown over this issue and not really over any serious objection to the spending bill itself. They want to get an extraneous measure on immigration on this bill. And I just think that's going to be kind of a heavy lift with the public when you have this thing just sitting there that if they just voted for, the government would stay open, but we'll see.
I don't think it's extraneous. I think, first of all, majorities of Americans support the Dreamers. I do think there is a funding issue here. Our guest may speak to that, but there is this fight between parity on defense and non-defense. And, you know, again, what is real security for Americans? Discretionary budget categories, you know, health, science, transportation, education, human services. So I think a budget is much more than just the financial figures. It's a statement of priorities. It's a statement of a country's values. So I think there is a real battle there, and much more than you suggest, Rich.
So this is fundamentally supposed to be a negotiation over spending. And Shai, I was wondering if you could explain this so-called spending caps issue for people, Republicans and Democrats fighting over the total amount of hundreds of billions of dollars of spending on defense spending and what's called non-defense discretionary spending. What is the practical effect of the negotiation over these caps, the numbers that they settle on? What will that mean in terms of what the government actually does?
Yeah, so this isn't anything new. As Katrina said, Republicans and Democrats have been debating spending priorities for the government since the dawn of time, or maybe not that long, but certainly since before I was born. And this current spending battle really originates from the Budget Control Act of 2011, which was an agreement between Republicans and Democrats putting caps on defense and what's called non-defense discretionary spending, which is the spending that funds on an annual basis most government agencies, programs that people interact with on a daily basis. It doesn't fund entitlements, so that's not Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera. But it is everything, you know, transportation, education, research into healthcare, all those sorts of things fall in those buckets, as well as defense on the other side. So they put caps on those, and then they set up this super committee, which was supposed to reach agreement on a broader debt reduction plan. Of course, as a lot of us remember, the super committee failed. And so what happened, according to the law, when that failed, is that the sequester caps went into effect, which were caps that were much lower than those initial spending caps that they had put in place. Nobody really wanted these caps. They were to try to incentivize policymakers to do the right thing on fiscal policy. But these caps are now in effect, and they last for 9 years, so through 2021. And we're about halfway through it. And over the years, they've reached deals to mitigate some of the impact of those, and they've increased those severe caps on defense and non-defense spending. But right now they're in the situation where for the next year there is no deal. And if those sequester level caps go into effect, it means no increase from today's levels, maybe even a slight cut for both defense and non-defense spending. And that's in the context of several years now, going on, you know, 5 or 6 years, where these parts of the budget have already been suppressed significantly. And so whether it's Democrats pushing on the non-defense side, saying that we've been underinvesting in things like research and education and transportation, et cetera, for many, many years, or Republicans generalizing on the defense side, saying we're not giving this sufficient support for our national security and our military, these are longstanding issues that have built up over recent years. And now we're in a situation where they're talking about increases on each side that could be on the order of $50 or even $80 billion in each year. And so if you add that up over a long period of time, because presumably if they increase it this year, they're not just going to let it fall back all the way down the next year. We're talking about large amounts of spending on both the domestic and defense sides of the budget here.
It just seems to me common sense, not left or right, that there be parity between defense and non-defense spending, which is what the Democrats are talking about. I mean, real security in the 21st century is about investing in a country's infrastructure, in its jobs, in its education, in its innovation, energy. And, you know, the Pentagon released a report a few years ago about security challenges in 2020, and it looked very hard at climate challenges, at environmental issues. So it just, you know, it does break down in a sense. I mean, you know, Democrats believe that earned benefits like Social Security should be preserved and not be subject to cuts if the Republicans drive up deficits. Republicans as a party back increased military spending. But the parity issue seems to me just vital.
See, it seems to me that parity is arbitrary. That we got here because when the Budget Control Act was enacted, it happened to be the case that there was approximately the same amount of federal government spending on defense functions and this whole bucket of non-defense discretionary functions in healthcare and transportation and all these other things. And because of the need to make bipartisan political deals, you ended up saying, well, Republicans care about the defense side, Democrats care about the non-defense side, so we'll increase it dollar for dollar. That analysis doesn't seem to me to reflect a question about what true spending priorities are. Are we spending too much on the military?
Yeah.
Are we spending too little on the military and it's not providing for a robust enough national defense? It seems to me like it's a political choice to have this dollar for dollar parity. And it's been weird for me because the budget process is supposed to be about that sort of priority spending. And instead, we've just had this daisy chain for years, starting with the Budget Control Act, where you reach these political compromises about what to spend more money on without really deep thinking about, you know, what the purpose of the federal government is and which of these things are really priorities.
I think that probably be exactly what ends up happening again, one way or the other. I don't know what the exact mix is, but I strongly suspect there will not be deep thinking about the priorities of our federal government, and they'll just end up being more spending both on defense and domestic.
Shai, what impact is there for the government when you have these sort of monthly funding bills? I mean, theoretically, this is supposed to be done once a year. Even if the process is not thoughtful about what the priorities are, you're at least supposed to have numbers a year in advance so agencies know what they'll have money available to spend on. How does it affect how the government operates when people are sort of waiting month to month to see whether and how much the federal government's going to be funded?
Yeah, that's right. And this is much more significant than I think the average American understands. I think members of Congress certainly understand it, and that's what's troubling. Taking a big picture look and seeing where we are today, we're 4 months into the start of this fiscal year, nearly 4 months, because it started last October 1st. And we're about to pass, presumably, either whether there's a shutdown or it's passed in advance of a shutdown, a fourth continuing resolution for this year. Now, what that means is that we are funding all of these discretionary programs at last year's levels with last year's priorities. Now, that would be a hell of a way to run a railroad. It's a really, really terrible way to run the federal government because it means inefficiency and waste. We are spending money on programs that are no longer priorities because they're from last year. We're not able to spend money on new programs, whether it's in defense or in these discretionary, other domestic discretionary agencies that presumably have new programs that they want to fund for the new year. And it also means that our level of spending is kept at last year's levels. And because, as we know, there's inflation, population growth, economic growth, the needs change. So we continue to do these short-term CRs year after year. Only four of the last 42 years has Congress passed all of these appropriations bills on time. And if that's not the sign of a broken process, I'm really not sure what is. So there are real impacts on how people experience the government from these CRs. A lot of them are over time, because it means inefficiency and waste. That means the government isn't able to conduct, whether it's research or investments or purchases of goods. So for example, if you have a short-term CR, it means that they can only purchase goods. For example, let's say the prison system, they're purchasing food for the prisoners. They can only purchase those goods for the period that the CR lasts. If they purchase in bulk, obviously economies of scale make that cheaper. So there are tons and tons of examples across the federal government of how much inefficiency and waste these continuing resolutions cause, and yet we continue to run the government in this fashion because of these ongoing political debates over the levels of spending that we're going to have.
I want to touch quickly on the Children's Health Insurance Program because that's been a key part of these negotiations. And one thing that would become a little less piecemeal if this continuing resolution passes is that we'd get a six-year funding plan for the Children's Health Insurance Program. Katrina, what do you make of the talking points from Republicans who are now saying, we're looking to fund Children's Health Insurance. Why are Democrats standing in the way?
Where have they been? Where have they been? And also, by the way, just on the spending issue, I mean, the Children's Health Insurance Program, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would cost nothing. I mean, it's just a valuable program that the Republicans have not really supported in any meaningful way and are now using as a bargaining chip at this moment in these fights. I just wanted to say one thing, because I think you were so right, Josh, that we've become hostages, prisoners to this kind of 2011 sequester budget deal, when in fact, if the country had the ability to really think about what its priorities were. You know, it's interesting to me, I wrote a column this past week that our endless wars may fuel the next populist revolt. And it's in the last three elections, Americans voted for the candidate most skeptical of these endless wars. Trump, you remember, talked about wasting $6 trillion on wars in the Middle East. Imagine if that money had been spent at home, he said. I think this is worth thinking about because I think the country is not anti-war, but it's anti-endless war and wants to bring some of that money home to rebuild our country and do so not in an isolationist way, but this country has a lot of work to do. Just, you know, we live in the city. Every day something's breaking down. I mean, the country's living on the carcass of the New Deal, the Great Society, and some investments made decades ago.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank Shia Kabas, Director of Economic Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, for joining us.
Sure. Thanks again for having me, Josh.
The Washington Post is reporting that Donald Trump has invited Chuck Schumer to the White House for a meeting about averting a shutdown. So maybe we actually won't have one tonight, but we'll see. And when you're hearing this on the radio, maybe you'll already know. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine to talk about who else? Steve Bannon. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Steve Bannon testified before the House Intelligence Committee this week, but not about everything they wanted to hear about. Bannon largely refused to answer questions about conversations he had during and after his service in the White House and even during the transition. Bannon made these refusals in consultation with a White House lawyer, officially to protect the ability of the White House to assert executive privilege about these conversations. Foreign Policy magazine reported that Trump personally made the decision to have Bannon withhold his testimony. But Bannon has also been subpoenaed to talk to someone else, Robert Mueller. And our next guest is reporting that Bannon is expected to be more forthcoming with him. Betsy Woodruff covers politics for the Daily Beast, and she joins us now. Hi, Betsy.
Hey, Josh. How are you?
Good. So what should we make of the sudden interest in Bannon from both congressional investigators and the special counsel?
First, I'm not convinced that this interest is super sudden. We've known for a while that he's someone who's been on the radar of people who have questions about the Russia matter. That said, obviously, the publication of Michael Wolff's book that included Bannon saying that he thought folks in the president's inner circle could be liable to money laundering charges is the kind of thing that would perk up investigators' ears. So not a huge surprise that he's gotten so much attention in the last few weeks. That said, one of the things that stood out to me most about the pretty wacky last 48 or 72 hours of Bannon being in and out of the House Intel Committee is that the White House doesn't really have a consistent way of essentially exerting executive privilege. The reason for that is that when Bannon went in for his interview, he had that first big interview a couple of days ago, he, of course, said that there were certain things he couldn't talk about because the president had told him not to. And the two things he cited were anything that happened during the transition and then things that happened in the White House. The White House's argument that they were making was executive privilege covers all this stuff and we don't want to talk about it. But then the next day, Rick Dearborn, who's a deputy chief of staff at the White House, also went to the House Intelligence Committee for a closed-door meeting. And what we're told is that he answered plenty of questions about things that happened after the campaign, things that at least theoretically would be covered by executive privilege. So I was told that Dearborn should expect a tongue-lashing from Don McGahn, the White House counsel, for being a bit of a wrench in the machinery of this executive privilege effort.
And so then what should we make of the subpoena from Mueller and this idea that he will talk to Mueller about things that he wouldn't talk to the House Intel Committee about? Why would he be willing to talk to the special counsel about why wouldn't those matters be similarly subject to executive privilege in conversations with a prosecutor?
The reason, and this is something that I've talked about with a number of extremely well-wired Republican attorneys who handle these matters, is that the White House's understanding of executive privilege is that it's essentially designed to preserve constitutional separation of powers matters. So what they'll say is, since Mueller is part of the executive branch, they'll argue that that executive privilege doesn't cover Mueller because he's already in the executive branch. They'll say, however, it's important that the White House exert its executive privilege powers when it comes to Congress, because that's the legislative branch. That said, though, one thing that you don't hear from Republican lawyers, but that is very much an issue here, is USA v. Nixon, the landmark Supreme Court decision, which found, and I'm putting this like in very much layman's terms, but which essentially found that executive privilege doesn't apply in criminal investigation.
One thing that struck me about this week's Bannon news is obviously Steve Bannon has been taken to the woodshed by the president, Sloppy Steve, as they're calling him. And all that we're hearing about this, an undercurrent of it seems to be Steve Bannon is demonstrating that he is still loyal to the president and that he is willing to infuriate both Democratic and Republican members of the House Intel Committee in his refusal to discuss matters that the president doesn't want him to discuss. Rich, are you surprised by the apparent level of cooperation here between Bannon and the White House?
Well, I think Bannon is desperate to crawl his way back somehow into the president's good graces, and he's seen his career basically destroyed by what he said, at least for now, to Michael Wolff. I think one big theme here that I think is unfortunate, ideally, what you would have happen in this investigation, you have congressional committees undertaking an investigation to find the facts and release them publicly so everyone could know. Instead, the committees are breaking down along partisan lines. You see Bannon sort of playing into this. He's not going to talk to the congressional committee, but he's going to talk to Robert Mueller. So instead of this sort of fact-finding expedition to inform the public, you have an investigation that's a black box that we know very little about that's being done under the auspices of a criminal investigation. And I don't think that really serves what's likely the real public, what the public needs.
But I think the real news here is Bannon supposedly telling Wolf, quote, this is all about money laundering, because I think it gives you a sense of the contours of where the Mueller investigation is going. I've said this before. I mean, I think in a perverse, interesting way, it's a drain the swamp investigation. He's brought on all these financial money laundering experts on his team. And I think you get, you know, there'll be a lot of questions about the Deutsche Bank loans. Who was allegedly involved in money laundering? Did this go back to the 90s when many U.S. banks cut off Trump, ties to Russian oligarchs who also had ties in the 90s to John McCain, et cetera? But I think that's where it seems to be going. And putting aside executive privilege, and I agree with Rich, the failure of the congressional committees to transcend increasingly partisan sniping, this becomes the black box, but this becomes the roadmap to
it's
what may occur.
It's not clear that Bannon knows anything, though, about money laundering. I mean, it's
no, I'm
pretty
just
clear to me.
I just think that's the direction, though, right, that they're going to head.
But Bannon's saying that, I think, out of pure hatred of Jared Kushner. What he would know about
Kushner,
is
of course, yeah.
Why did they fire Comey? What was the process like putting out the dishonest statements about the Don
Sessions
Jr.
Sessions' decision
meetings?
To recuse himself,
right.
Those kinds of things.
Betsy, what's your sense of the level of fear in the White House about what Steve Bannon might say to Bob Mueller? As both Rich and Katrina have noted, Bannon has a tendency to run his mouth. It's possible that some of these accusations are empty and he has nothing that's actually admissible in court to say about them. But on the other hand, maybe he does have some knowledge that would be relevant to Bob Mueller's investigation.
I think anyone from the White House talking to Mueller is something that causes anxiety in the president's inner circle, in large part because the more information that Mueller has, the more likely it is that he's going to find something that is a problem for the White House. The biggest concern for the White House, in my understanding, isn't necessarily that these investigators, and especially investigators on Mueller's team, will find something troubling that happened during the campaign, but rather that they will overturn evidence of financial crimes or troubling financial practices, and that itself will be the much bigger issue. I mean, remember, Ken Starr started out investigating real estate deals in Arkansas
Whitewater.
And somehow found out about the president's sexual dalliances in the Oval Office. The indictments that Mueller has brought forward, as well as the folks who've pleaded guilty, none of the crimes that have specifically, certifiably come to light because of the Mueller investigation are crimes that were committed during the campaign. George Papadopoulos lied to the FBI after Election Day. Michael Flynn lied to the FBI after Election Day. Paul Manafort and Rick Gates are in significant legal trouble because of things that they did in 2015 and in the years before 2015. That's a big part of the reason that this is concerning for the White House, because it's not narrowly tailored at all. It's not just focused on Russia. And, I mean, look, if you talk to folks you know about the New York real estate market in the 90s, they'll tell you anyone who was doing work in luxury real estate probably one way or another got his hands dirty.
Betsy Woodruff of The Daily Beast, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing.
Still with me are on the left, Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now we're going to talk about nukes. The Nuclear Posture Review, a draft proposal on nuclear weapons policy from the Pentagon, would allow for American use of nuclear weapons in response to serious non-nuclear attacks, including large-scale cyber attacks. This is reported by The New York Times. The draft would build on existing policy, which already allows for nuclear-first use as an option in response to other serious non-nuclear attacks, including biological weapon attacks. Current and former officials stressed to the Times that conventional weapons responses are also available in these situations. They would not automatically lead to a nuclear strike. To discuss this, we're joined by Tom Nichols, who is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College and author of the book No Use, Nuclear Weapons and U.S. National Security. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Is this a sensible thing to be threatening, that we might in some cases use nuclear weapons to respond to major cyber attacks?
Well, I don't think so, and this is a good time for me to point out that I don't represent the views of the Navy or the Naval War College on this. I don't think it's a good idea to threaten nuclear use for any reason other than to deter the use of nuclear weapons against the United States. But there has long been a group of folks, and I think since the end of the Cold War, even really since the end of the Reagan administration, who have been trying to kind of push this role of nuclear weapons back onto the front burner to kind of restore the primacy of nuclear weapons for almost any reason and squeeze some kind of political utility out of the American nuclear arsenal. But I think it's a terrible idea.
People occasionally talk about tactical nuclear weapons, this idea that you can have weapons for a small nuclear attack rather than as part of a, you know, a major global nuclear war. Are there strategies where that really works? Is that something that can be part of U.S. policy?
Well, again, I don't think so, but it depends on who you talk to. I mean, there are people who will happily tell you that, look, we could use, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 really small nuclear weapons and the whole thing won't escalate out of control. But, you know, as Henry Kissinger once pointed out, he had a great line about this, which is that there's a virginity to nuclear weapons, that once it's lost, you're not going to reacquire it. That, you know, after 1945 and the end of World War II, there was a kind of this threshold that said, no matter how big a nuclear weapon is, once you split an atom in anger, you've opened Pandora's box there. You've really gone down that road. And I think this is partly the urge to conventionalize nuclear weapons. It's to say, you know, it's difficult to do things with conventional weapons, so we're going to treat small nuclear weapons like they're just big conventional weapons. But it really leaves aside the fact that these are weapons that are different in character.
Rich, does this make you nervous?
Well, I don't know whether trying to establish a nuclear deterrent against a cyber attack is a good idea or whatever work. I do think it's a good idea. Another thing that we're hearing that's going to be in this nuclear posture review is a push to develop low-yield nuclear weapons, which I think is, again, very unlikely you would ever use. But if we're going to get in a situation with North Korea and potentially Iran down the line where we are deterring a nuclear power, part of deterrence is having believably usable weapons in a crisis. And a low-yield nuclear weapon, if some extreme circumstance arises where you have to take a deep bunker out in North Korea in a crisis, is more appropriate than some city-busting enormous bomb. So I think this would be just an extension of the deterrent regime we have been living with since the advent of the atomic weapon.
I think this is madness, because this is not what we've been living with. This is now, in this nuclear posture review, an administration calling for possible use of nuclear weapons, usable nuclear weapons that will lower the threshold for launching a nuclear conflict. I mean, leading policy analysis, Tom may speak to this, and independent scientists have already warned that this new policy will increase the likelihood of a nuclear conflict that can quickly spiral out of control. The administration's breaking with longstanding bipartisan consensus in favor of reducing nuclear arsenals, limiting the scenarios in which they might be used. Nukes are not usable. The small nukes we're talking about, guys, I mean, those are, Tom may disagree, but I mean, you're talking on the level of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And I think the idea of making, even normalizing the idea of nukes is extremely dangerous. What we should be talking about is mutual, verifiable de-escalation, build down, moving to what Henry Kissinger, no radical, talked about abolition of nuclear weapons, and at a minimum taking the Russian U.S. 2,000 nukes off of hair trigger alert. We saw in Hawaii just a few days ago the real danger of misperception, of accidents, of false alarms. And, you know, if you have these things on hair trigger, it can move very quickly into a radically horrific situation.
Well, so Tom, if nuclear weapons are not usable, then they're not effective as a deterrent, right? Because you can't credibly threaten to use them. So what should the U.S. be saying about when it might use nuclear weapons, and what sort of arsenal would we need in order to have those effective threats to discourage nuclear activity or other things by other countries?
Well, nuclear weapons can serve as a deterrent, but there's two problems here, and this is one of those weird moments where I'm ending up more in agreement with Katrina than Rich. First, the idea of developing these smaller weapons or bunker busters or usable, you know, quote unquote usable nuclear weapons, it leaves aside the point that the nuclear weapons, the use of a nuclear weapon, is a political act. That, you know, there's really not a lot of military necessity here. And it also assumes that you can somehow tell the difference in the end between a nuclear bomb and, you know, that it won't do the same kind of damage that a large nuclear weapon will do, when in fact the idea that somehow you can use, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 tactical nuclear weapons, you know, and you're not going to suffer these, you know, bring about these tremendous consequences that you would have with conventional weapons. It simply makes no sense. Nuclear weapons have particular effects, and their use is a political act. The bigger problem for me is that when you present the president, any president, with a bunch of nuclear options, what you're really saying is, here, you have a lot of choices and you should pick from them. When I was working on this some years ago, someone said to me, when I said, you know, we really should keep these, and this answers your question, Josh, you know, what should we do with these? And I said, we should keep them as a deterrent against existential attacks that could end the system of government and life in North America, and other than that, not really talk about them very much. Someone said, well, you're trying to limit the president's options, to which I replied, you're darn right I am. I don't want somebody to be able to walk in and say, here's 15 options for the use of nuclear weapons during a crisis. I think that's a very dangerous thing.
So in that context, what should we think about the president's tweet a few weeks ago about the size and functionality of his nuclear button, seeming at least to project that he thinks he has significant nuclear options with regard to North Korea?
But he does. I mean, if you go back to what he didn't understand during the campaign, remember the triad? I mean, all three, quote, legs of the triad at a cost of many hundreds of millions of dollars, each alone is more than sufficient to incinerate any conceivable aggressor. And especially at a time, it's just madness again, that we're talking about increasing the size or modernizing or replacing, when these funds are desperately needed to rebuild America's deteriorating infrastructure. It's a money issue only.
Issue.
I mean, they are going to, but it's money in the sense that this nuclear posture review, correct me if I'm wrong, is going to throw more money. I mean, there is the discussion of more money. And by the way, and to be transpartisan about this, President Obama, largely under pressure, but he moved with the pressure, was ready to throw, was it a trillion?
Yeah
over three decades on modernizing the nuclear arsenal. I think that, you know, what's crazy is that this is all putting us at far greater risk than a strategy aimed at reducing the role of nukes in our military strategy. And to go along with the majority of countries in the world which signed a treaty calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Again, not someone I usually quote, but there were four horsemen of the apocalypse, as I remember: Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, a general, Shalakashvili, and one other, who talked about abolition as the more realistic. Bill Perry, who's become an evangelical voice, a prophet, warning of the dangers of accidental nuclear disaster.
And that's the real worry. I mean, this is not, the money's been spent. I mean, President Obama, again, whether, you know, it was under pressure or whether he was finally convinced it was a good idea, and we're going to plow $1 trillion into these things over the next 30 years. I didn't think that was a good idea either. Mm-hmm. But the larger problem is now we're developing strategies to, or we're kind of opening the door again to saying, you know, these aren't really unthinkable weapons. They're not really for the existential defense of the United States. They're for all kinds of other problems that we're just not creative enough to solve in any other way. This is what I call the nuclear crutch, that nuclear weapons are always inserted as a kind of dummy variable into the security problems. Hey, you know, maybe we should draw down our size of our forces in South Korea. Well, what if something happens? And then, well, nuclear weapons.
The Russians and the Chinese are modernizing their arsenals. The Chinese are building more warheads and building more delivery systems. And we need to keep up with that potential large-scale threat. And then there's a new circumstance, which we may end up in a nuclear exchange with North Korea, not of our doing. And that's an extreme scenario. It's not one you want to happen. But if North Korea, you know, nukes Tokyo, and we need to act really quickly to neutralize any future threats emanating from bunkers that might not be vulnerable to conventional weapons, I can't spin out all the scenarios here, you just want to have the options. And tactical nuclear weapons are not a new phenomenon. And we haven't. Well, then your argument should be we should abolish them because we're, you know, on the precipice of using them, where we've actually had them and not used them.
We have those options. And the Chinese and the Russian argument, I think, is not a very compelling argument because the Chinese and the Russians are modernizing to get closer to where we are. I mean, in a way, I'm almost glad the Russians are modernizing because I was worried about how decrepit their forces and particularly their command and control are. The fact of the matter is, you know, that we're not under any more threat from the Russians today than we were 10 years ago. And this notion that somehow we have to keep up with the Russians and the Chinese modernizing is, you know, the same argument that says that we have to keep improving versions of stealth fighters to catch up with the Chinese version that's six generations behind us. I think this is a straw man, and it's, again, another way of saying that the default answer from the nuclear establishment, and again, good time to point out that I don't represent any of them, the default answer from the nuclear establishment is always build more nukes and find ways to use them. And the creative answer should be to say reduce nuclear weapons and find better conventional answers to these strategic problems, because you can't simply balance out every problem you have in the world by inserting the words nuclear weapons. And I think that's what we're doing again.
We're going to have to leave it there. I've been talking with Tom Nichols of the Naval War College, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Rich Lowry of National Review. Rich, Katrina, and I will be back with historian Neil Ferguson to talk about The Square and the Tower, his new book about the decline of hierarchies and the rise of networks from Al-Qaeda to Facebook. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Before we get to networks and hierarchies and 500 years of history, I want to talk about a porn star. According to the Wall Street Journal, Stormy Daniels, who has appeared in such films as Good Will Humping and Two Girls for Every Girl 2, received a $130,000 payment arranged by Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, in the final days of the 2016 presidential campaign. This payment was in exchange for an agreement not to discuss her relationship with Donald Trump. But years before she signed that agreement, back in 2011, Daniels gave a lengthy interview to In Touch Weekly magazine in which she described having a consensual affair with Trump in 2006. In the interview, Daniels said sex with Trump was, quote, textbook generic, and that Trump told her she was beautiful and smart, just like his daughter, Ivanka. Through Cohen, Trump has issued a statement denying the affair. So nobody really cares about this except to laugh at it. Should we care about the private moral behavior of the president that he allegedly and, you know, let's be honest, very likely had this affair just months after the birth of his youngest child?
Well, I mean, it speaks to a low character. I mean, it's extremely sleazy dealings, not just with her at the time at the celebrity golf tournament, but right on the cusp of the election when they paid her off not to, what I assume, is tell the truth. Now, I think politically, it's kind of baked in the cake. This is something that people already know about Donald Trump, and I only think these kind of allegations become a real going political concern again. One, if this sort of conduct has somehow continued in the White House, or two, he gets himself in a situation where he lies about one of these alleged affairs under oath. Both of those rules Bill Clinton violated and gotten in a world of hurt. And I think Trump would be facing the same thing if those two things were true. Otherwise, you know, it's gross and it's titillating and people are pointing and laughing, but I don't think it's anything more than that.
You know, there's so many reasons to be outraged by Trump that an extramarital affair with a porn actress doesn't quite cut it. even within the arena of his sexual behavior. I mean, think the allegation that Trump assaulted porn actress Jennifer Drake in 2006 seems more serious to me. It is interesting to me about the right on this issue because Jeet here wrote, a social commentator wrote an interesting column, and he raised the issue of how Trump's ascendancy over the Republican Party marks a little noticed but real shift in American politics. Social conservatives, who once led the crusade against smut, remember the Mies Commission and all of that, have made their peace with porn-saturated culture.
Isn't this kind of odd? What happened to, like, moral values?
Yeah. Well, look, it's we've talked about this before, but social conservatives were sort of the leading edge of the people saying on the right, you know what, we can deal with Donald Trump. You know, we don't like him. He wasn't our first choice, but we can deal with him. And they are right on that level. They've gotten every single thing they wanted from him, from religious liberty issues to life issues.
But not quite had everything. There was an executive order on non-discrimination by government contractors that they hope to get reversed.
Right, just a little, yeah. You know, that's a little daylight. But it comes at the cost of compromising with this guy that they never would have, you know, if you told them 2 years ago this would be the situation, they would say, no, we could never possibly work ourselves into this kind of conundrum. And they have, but also an element of conservative thinking on this is, okay, we were the big morality people all during the 1990s, and what did it get us?
Feminists
flipped around and found every justification to defend Bill Clinton so that there's no upside.
Okay, on a more highbrow note, I want to bring in Neil Ferguson, who is the Milbank Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and who's the author of a new book, The Square and the Tower. President Trump says he won by bypassing the hierarchies that opposed him and organizing a network of supporters that other Republican politicians like Mitt Romney couldn't. And that's one reason Neil's book, which looks at the balance of power through history between top-down hierarchies and bottom-up networks, is particularly timely. Neil, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So your thesis is that we're in a time where the hierarchies are in decline, and you seem pretty alarmed by that. Why?
Well, I think we were told over the last 20 or so years by the folks in Silicon Valley that everything would be awesome if we were all connected and that creating giant online social networks would lead to a global community. I think that's Mark Zuckerberg's phrase. But history and network science rather argue against that happy outcome. And part of the point of this book is to draw a series of analogies with previous periods when technology has empowered social networks relative to established hierarchies of governance. The big analogy that I point to is with the period of the Reformation. Martin Luther would not have been able to challenge the Roman Catholic hierarchy had there not been printing presses all over Europe to disseminate his words. Luther thought that if he could only get scripture to ordinary people in the vernacular, they'd have a direct relationship to God without a corrupt priesthood in between, and you'd get that wonderful priesthood of all believers that the Bible talks about. Well, actually, he got 130 years of religious conflict in Europe that dragged on into the middle of the 17th century. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that that's not too surprising because we know that large networks don't tend to be homogeneous. They tend to be polarized. And that polarization effect or self-segregation into clusters is what we also see in our own time, where it's politics that has been transformed by the advent of giant online social networks.
So, but when looking at the Reformation, obviously there were also substantial upsides to it, right? It was a reaction against a Catholic Church that had come to be abusing its position as a hierarchy. So isn't there something to be celebrated about these networks when they're able to disrupt a hierarchy that is not acting in the best interest of the public? What's the way to harness the upside of that network power without all of the strife and war that we saw in the Reformation?
Yeah, as somebody who's kind of against polarization, I'm also against false dichotomies, and the book actually tries to show that there isn't a simple dichotomy between square and tower, network and hierarchy, that there's a kind of continuum from completely distributed decentralized networks to extraordinarily centralized hierarchical networks. The point I'm making is not that social networks are bad. It's just that if you create large social networks, you shouldn't expect a kind of happy, clappy feeling of warm togetherness. A good illustration of the of this is that it's not just science that goes viral in the 17th century. It's also notions of witchcraft. And there's this kind of crazy notion that there are witches everywhere that sweeps through places where the Reformation's happened, leading to enormous numbers of witch burnings. So the book is trying to say, let's not have a kind of binary view of social networks, that they're either all good and going to create a global community or all wicked. As so often in history, there's a kind of balance sheet, and you have to recognize, as I don't think we did when, say, Facebook was being created, that there are risks to a completely distributed social network without any real hierarchical control.
I take Neil's point, and Neil, congratulations on the book, that he is not promoting a simplistic polarity here. But I would just go back to the example of the Reformation. Yes, there are downsides, I think, to every social movement and technological advance. But I think the general tendency is the more information, the better. The translation of the Bible into English was an amazing event. The rise of a print culture in England that eventually came over to these shores created a more liberal society and undermined attempts to create a hierarchical, absolutist type of monarchy of the sort you saw on the continent. So I think it's very difficult to identify any of these trends and just say they're bad, because it goes to human nature. They're mixed.
I'm curious your thinking, because you know, the big Silicon Valley tech companies, Google, Facebook, have become so powerful, have begun to make their weight felt politically, which you write a little bit about in the book. Some of it is because they're so lightly regulated. You point out they're not subject to the same kinds of law as other information or content providers. What kind of regulation would you suggest is needed to limit their power to protect the public from the way they use their dominant positions in the context of hierarchy, in the context of networks?
The structure of the public sphere has been dramatically altered in around a decade, not least by the advent of Facebook, something which now provides about 45% of Americans with their news. And that makes Mark Zuckerberg the most powerful publisher of content probably ever, certainly more powerful than William Randolph Hearst at the height of his power. And yet, as you rightly observe, there's an anomaly in the regulation dating back to before Facebook, before Mark Zuckerberg even got to Harvard, to the mid-1990s, essentially exempts the network platforms, mm-hmm. as they like to call themselves, from any liability for the content that appears on their sites. And that means that the playing field certainly isn't level, and that skew has, I think, helped the network platforms establish their dominance, not least in online advertising. There's a big debate, which you'll all be aware of, about antitrust and whether these companies are monopolies or near monopolies and should be broken mm-hmm. up. I suspect that's the wrong debate, because certainly as I understand the existing state of the law, it would be quite hard to show on the basis of our current understanding of antitrust that there is a disadvantage to consumers from the way Google and Facebook, or for that matter, Amazon operate. But I think this issue of regulation being basically asymmetrical and advantaging the Silicon Valley companies is a huge one. And I'm quite surprised there's not more discussion of this, given the enormous political power that these platforms now exercise. I don't think the election of 2016 is intelligible without the recognition that Facebook is the most powerful tool for political advertising ever invented. And without it, I don't think Donald Trump could have won that election. Mm-hmm. If we simply leave things as they are, I think we are in a completely unstable environment in which the network platforms become the public sphere, and they don't just generate enormous revenue from it. They can be instrumentalized by any good or bad political actor with the kind of targeted advertising that essentially breaks up the public sphere. Sam Lesson wrote a great essay about this on The Information not so long ago, making the argument that we're all worried about echo chambers or filter bubbles, but actually it's the total fragmentation of the public sphere, so that each of us gets the news feed that the algorithm thinks we most want to see and will most engage us. There is no public sphere in that state of affairs, and there's no way of monitoring what your neighbour is being told reality is out there. I don't think we're fully digesting the implications of what happened in 2016. Maybe it has to happen a couple of more times before we wake up and say, hang on a minute, something fundamentally unstable is being created.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
When the Clive and Bundy standoff happened in 2014, I think most of us assumed that the rancher and his supporters were lying about the various abuses that they alleged by the federal government. Well, now it turns out a federal judge has tossed the criminal case against Bundy based on flagrant abuses by the federal government. It goes to show that the old adage is true, that even paranoiacs have enemies.
Katrina, what's your rant?
Ready for an anti-Trump wave this November? Check out Wisconsin. Trump's defenders like to claim his base is so blindly loyal that nothing he says or does will ever drive its members away, but news from across the country should shatter that view. A large majority of voters, including erstwhile Trump supporters, is rebelling. That message was delivered this past Tuesday in the rural 10th Senate district in Wisconsin's western reaches, where Democratic Patty Shachner defeated a GOP assemblyman by an impressive 9 points in a special election. Trump carried that district by 17 points in the last presidential. Seat had been held by a Republican for 17 years, and it was the Dems' 34th legislative pickup from Republicans since Trump's election.
For my rant, I want to applaud Delta Airlines for their announcement of a new policy cracking down on fake service animals. Delta says customers have attempted to fly with comfort turkeys, possums, snakes, and spiders. You are entitled under federal law to bring an emotional support animal on board a plane without a carrier. But since you can get an ESA certification online for any animal for about $200, many people are abusing the law to bring their pets on board. Delta will now require a signed certification that your so-called emotional support animal has been trained to behave. This isn't a big barrier in itself. The pet owner can sign their own certification, but hopefully it will induce a sense of shame for people who are abusing a benefit that's supposed to be for people with disabilities. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Shia Kabas, Tom Nichols, Betsy Woodruff, and Neil Ferguson. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.